I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the heart of the Middle East in the UAE, a sectoral dialogue partner of ASEAN, which will be meeting in Malaysia, whose foreign minister recently called out the genocide in Gaza. US President Trump, who attempted to broker a ceasefire in that genocide, armed by the USA, UK, and EU, is for his part scheduled to be in Malaysia, Japan, and South Korea. But what about the USA's ongoing wars, the proxy war in Ukraine against Russia, the war on Venezuela, and the war on Iran? Former Marine Corps and Pentagon official Matthew Ho knows all about the inner workings of the U.S. military and its industrial complex. He was an Obama-Clinton U.S. State Department official who resigned over the USA's doomed longest war in its history, Afghanistan. After that $4 trillion-plus war, he's now a fellow at the Eisenhower Media Network, and he joins me from Wake Forest in North Carolina. Matt, it's so good to see you. It's been 7 years since you've been on Going Underground, I'm told. Where to start? So Trump is in Southeast Asia trying to sign a peace deal between Thailand and Cambodia. Not sure how that fits with him celebrating Kissinger. And scattered through his cabinet seem to be opponents of his attempted peace deals in Gaza and Ukraine. What are the forces ranged against Trump right now from within?
Well, it's good to be back on with you, Afshin. I think we're seeing now what many of us worried about when we came to understand what Trump's government was going to look like in this term, who he was putting on his cabinet. He's surrounding himself essentially by neoconservatives. And so when the efforts, say, in particular with Russia, have not progressed the way that Donald Trump had hoped they would, the people around him who have been anti-Russia to their core, whether it's his Secretary of State / National Security Advisor Marco Rubio, his former now security advisor, now UN ambassador, Michael Waltz, Scott Bessent, his treasury secretary, you know, and so on. These are all men who are hawks on Russia. So when things haven't progressed with Russia the way that Trump would have liked, they have said to him, Mr. President, we, you know, certainly appreciate you trying, but as we told you, the Russians only understand force. And so this is what we see throughout his cabinet, men and women who are neoconservatives at their core, who are no different in that extent than their liberal interventionist counterparts in, say, the Obama or Biden White Houses. And so what we can essentially expect to see is a continuation of the American empire as we've seen it, just with this flavor and color that comes with Donald Trump as being president.
I mean, you were at the Pentagon and State Department. What, if we consider Pete Hegseth at the head of the Pentagon as a sort of more benign figure, who knows, perhaps not benign if you're in the military or a veteran, but elsewhere, what power does Rubio have? I mean, I noticed, in the Sulzberger New York Times, it says, NATO must act to stop Russia's dangerous new campaign. And it's all happening in the American press about the, I don't know what the new campaign is, by the way. I don't know. They think Moscow is about to invade Belgium. What powers does Rubio have? I mean, clear that Rubio is behind this push on Venezuela, would you say?
Oh, absolutely. And I think this was the remit that Marco Rubio wanted. Was to have a focus on not just Venezuela, but all of Central and South America. If people recall, there was criticism of him as not being as fully involved in, say, with affairs with Russia or affairs in the Middle East, that he was being superseded by Steve Witkoff. And I think what you've seen here is just simply a division of responsibility, where Rubio has his entire career been obsessed with Latin America. And so he is in a position where he can enact what his ambitions have wanted for decades. And you see a division of labor then as well. You see with, say, Jared Kushner being brought back into the fold, Kushner, who was very involved, the president's son-in-law, who was very involved in the Middle East affairs of the first Trump administration. You've seen him now being brought back into the administration to deal with affairs in the Middle East. You know, as well, you see others such as a General Kellogg heavily invested in the efforts with regards to Ukraine and Russia. So what we're seeing, I think, is just what you'd expect, a division of labor, but certainly looking at each of their biases, their personal histories, their desires, right, their ideologies, what they've stated, you can see how this portioning of or allotment of responsibility really has fallen under rather nefarious characters.
Yeah, because Rubio hadn't been so involved. And then last week, he had a phone call with Lavrov, which seemed to cause the postponing of the Budapest summit between Putin and Trump. Do you think that's what happened? And what powers in the State Department does Rubio have to sabotage any attempts at peace that Trump and some people say Tulsi Gabbard, although given that Trump seems to talk about things with clearly erroneous information half the time. I'm not sure what national intelligence he's getting from the Director of National Intelligence. But what power at the State Department to subvert any Trump peace agenda?
Well, first, right, let's speak about Gabbard for a second, because that's a name, you know, someone here in the United States whose job is to follow this. She's a name I have not really seen in the last several months. So talk about someone getting sidelined, someone who is willing.
She was at the Diwali celebrations, I think, at the celebrations, yeah, right. which somehow didn't mention the tariffs over Russian oil to India. But
right, exactly. So you see it that way, where she's put out in these public events. But you don't even see her at the cabinet meetings sometimes, you know. So her being limited, her being sidelined, and the elevation then of John Ratcliffe, the CIA director, who is, you know, a neoconservative, who is hawkish on Russia, hawkish on Iran, certainly a Zionist, someone who is who people believe has been put in that position because he is so manageable for the various special interests that dominate the American empire when it comes to foreign policy. You asked about Rubio and what he can do to sabotage things. I mean, certainly as a Secretary of State, with the power over the embassies, his staff, his ability just even to say to slow roll things. But I think what you had with the Rubio-Lavrov conversation was a realization that things simply weren't there to allow for a meeting to go forward, not even a meeting of Rubio and Lavrov. You know, Ashley, when you have these types of high-level meetings, whether it's between foreign ministers or heads of state especially, you know, deals are supposed to essentially be done. This is not the time for haggling or negotiating or bargaining. By the time these men and women get together who are in senior positions, it's supposed to be a handshake, photo op, sign the papers moment. And I think that was the realization that occurred in the last weeks or so, is that nothing has changed since Alaska. There's been no movement on either side in any appreciable way that would allow for the two sides to come together to create a deal. And so this is the position that they're stuck in. And then, of course, the Europeans, egging the Ukrainians on, seem to be doing everything they can to ensure that the gap remains as wide as possible. And there's also such a vagueness and such a fog in all of this, where we simply don't know what's occurring. With the cancellation or postponement, we don't even know if the Trump-Putin summit is canceled or postponed, but we also don't know, according to one spokesperson from the Kremlin, who said that how do you cancel something that was never even planned? That maybe the summit wasn't even ever really agreed upon. And then, you know, I see Donald Trump taking credit for canceling it. Yeah, I mean, so we don't even know what is actually occurring here. There's such vagueness, such a fog, but we do know that there has been anything put forward by either side that would allow for a peace process to continue forward. And so we're essentially stuck in this position watching, you know, the slaughter in Ukraine continue with, you know, particularly an unreasonable response from the Europeans, that the Americans, those, as we talked about before, the Kelloggs, the Waltzes, the Rubios, the Ratcliffes, are in agreement with. So, you know, unfortunately, we're in a terrible position where, you know, this war continues without, at this moment, any, you know, sign that there is a prospect for a deal to be put in place.
Yeah, at the time of this interview, it's unclear whether it might happen. I mean, Trump could easily fly back from his trip in Southeast Asia, of course. But, I mean, it is of value that there are these meetings and phone calls. Of course, there were none under Genocide Joe and the Biden administration, clearly, because, I mean, the headlines, shocked headlines in the Financial Times. Trump warned Zelensky in meeting that Russia could destroy Ukraine. clearly important because the Tomahawk missiles were taken off the table, which was clearly a Putin red line that Putin explained to Trump in the phone call. So that was useful.
It was, but the Tomahawks, I think, were a talking point put forward by the Americans to appease the hawks, to appease the Europeans, to appease the press, to make it seem as if they are putting pressure on the Russians, because it was an empty threat. We simply don't have the weapon systems to launch the Tomahawks to give the Ukrainians. And the same with any of the other weapon systems that have been brought up in the last couple months, the Barracuda missiles, the ERAM missiles, all these various wonder weapons. And we've seen, you know, a host, a list of wonder weapons, you know, option as long as my arm, that were supposed to have won this war for Ukraine, whether it be the Abrams tank, the HIMARS missiles, right, the F-16s, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it was always a bit of an empty threat. I don't think anyone expected.
It's like arms company public relations.
Essentially. What it did, though, on a strategic level, so they were talking about the tactical operational levels, the conduct of the war, whether or not these weapons would make a difference in the war. But on the bigger picture, the strategic picture, what the Tomahawks did do is break open again the question or the grievance that the Russians have had for decades now about the encroachment of American and NATO weapon systems on Russia, right? This is one of the core grievances of the war, one of the core issues that Russia has been articulating through successive American administrations, this idea of encirclement, most especially highlighted then by the emplacement of American missile batteries in Poland and Romania. So the Tomahawks brought to center again, I think, to the fore this strategic question, this national security imperative that is at the root of Russia's reasons for this war. While they were an empty gesture in terms of being a threat, while, of course, there was an escalatory danger to them, even though they were an empty gesture, if you could still have both of those things occurring at the same time, the bigger thing was this exposed, again, one of the root causes of the war, encirclement of Russia by NATO and the United States.
Important for Russia and perhaps China to impose red lines on this and protect Venezuela in the face of the constant, well, they seem to be just killing fishermen, the Trump administration, right, for no apparent reason, but important for them to enforce a red line and put their missiles, perhaps, in Venezuela?
I don't think that's anything anyone wants to see, just because we had that experience in 1961.
What could go wrong?
I think we're lucky to be here, kind of thing. As well as, too, I don't think the Russians and the Chinese have the desire to poke the Americans, to escalate against the Americans in the way that the Americans and the Europeans have the desire to do so with Russia and China. And that's certainly a fundamental difference between the various nations' foreign policies and agendas. You know, not sitting here apologizing or cheerleading for either Russia or China, but certainly you look at the way that they conduct themselves in relation to other great powers, you see that there is not an interest to poke the other side in the eye as it would be. Now, certainly what Russia and China and the rest of the world should do in order to try and defend Venezuela from another Iraq, from another Syria, from another Libya, is clear. I mean, the need to stand up against the United States to prevent, in whatever way possible, an American regime change operation in Venezuela is paramount. But at the same time, too, you have American dominance in the Western Hemisphere that makes it very difficult for any nation to do anything. And the idea of say, sanctions against the United States, which would be the logical thing to do, that's the logical thing for the Americans to do whenever something upsets them, is to sanction someone. So that would be the logical
response. Hold that thought, Matt. Matthew Ho, I'll stop you there. More from the former U.S. State Department and Pentagon official after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the former U.S. State Department and Pentagon official and Iraq War combat veteran, Matthew Ho. Matt, I was interrupting you in part one when you were talking about the I suppose, importance of national sovereignty and sovereign armies and navies to protect Latin and Central American countries against the wrath of any Trump administration attacks. Nicaragua, I should say, has survived any of the attacks. But we were talking about Venezuela, of course.
Right, right. Certainly the long history of American involvement in Central and South America, you know, goes back centuries. But, you know, certainly the modern history of it is quite bloody, quite ugly, and shows the length to which the American governments will go to maintain dominance in the Western Hemisphere. And that won't change, you know, militarily. What the point I was reaching for was the idea that there need to come, there need to be other mechanisms in the world available to if not preclude, then to punish, or at least provide some consequences to the Americans for actions. If regime change occurs in Venezuela, and if it goes the way that history tells us it will, so it'll look like the other regime change operations throughout the history, in not just, you know, in Central America and South America, which are legion, we know how that's going to go. And so how do you at least punish the Americans for it? And I think you see a point with that, where the American economy is dependent upon other sources. The American economy is fragile. It can be exposed. So, you know, case in point being in the last week or so, last 2 weeks maybe, when the Chinese put forward their controls on rare earth minerals, metals, and magnets. That snapped the Americans' attention right away. That got the Americans to come to heel. That, you know, there is some bluster, but now, of course, you know, the United States is now negotiating it with China. Trump says he's going to meet Xi. So, I mean, there has to be mechanisms that are developed, and we're seeing the potential for that as this multipolar world develops, as alternatives to American financial, monetary, and economic order are developed, such as through BRICS. But in the meantime, there needs to be some type of concerted effort by nations outside of that top tier of the American sphere of influence, so essentially the Europeans, to do something to oppose any type of American regime change in Venezuela. And that has to come through in a way that is similar to what the Chinese did recently with their control of, again, rare earth minerals and metals.
Yeah, at the time of this interview, Trump has just threatened China over that. And of course, one should remember that the United States is a massive importer of Russian uranium, and Russia still seems supplying that to him. But of course, Trump never ceases to say, even while he sympathizes with the bereaved from all these wars, he always says it's good for business. At the same time, he seems to be able to flip very quickly between the dead bodies of children and how good it is for the American economy. And again, the FT, U.S. Army enlists buyout firms in drive to fund $150 billion overhaul of equipment. Pentagon hunts for capital. The U.S. Army has challenged private equity groups, Apollo Carlyle, KKR, to pitch meaty strategic projects. How does this play with the American people, do you think? I mean, I'll get onto the MAGA base, that clearly do not want these kinds of regime change wars. And we can discount the Democrats because they always support war. But how does it play that it's good for the economy to fund the mass murder of children?
You know, this is one of those things where that's the narrative, that's the mantra, that $1 trillion defense budget, well, think of all the jobs that are created. When all the evidence we have, all the research has been done, the multiple studies that are available, you know, demonstrate that money put into the military industrial complex is the least efficient form of job creation. You know, you can line up 20 different industries that you could put money into, government money into, and defense, the national security, weapons, et cetera, is dead last in terms of jobs creation. And we've known this for decades. But that doesn't stop the mantra. And that mantra is a cover for it all. But I think, you know, more importantly, this idea of the Americans, American public supporting regime change, I think in this case, people are so distracted by all the other challenges, all the other problems, all the other struggles and issues occurring in the United States right now, that I think the Trump administration feels that they could get through this in a way that their predecessors would not have been able to. The other thing too to factor into all this and to see how the Trump administration handles it is that, you know, starting with the second Barack Obama administration, the United States really, as part of their war policies, made an effort to make the wars as limited as possible for American involvement, essentially making the wars all be proxy wars. You saw this even in Afghanistan, where in 2013, you see a shift in American focus there, where American troops really aren't allowed off the bases anymore. It's all done through proxies, whether they be local forces, whether they be contractors, or whether they be, say, special operations or CIA forces that are covert or clandestine, and so not acknowledged. The idea being that they have to hide the wars from the American people, because the wars do have a real political impact. Certainly, you've seen that in American elections in 06, 08, and again in 2016, that the wars overseas had impact, a tremendous impact on the elections here in the United States. And so both parties know that. So how the Trump administration would handle that, something such as a regime change operation in Venezuela, we have to see. You know, certainly the groundwork has been laid for such an operation for decades now. I mean, this goes back to Chavez coming into power, that American administrations have been figuring out ways to get rid of the government in Venezuela. So you have to assume that there is some type of infrastructure in place to carry out a regime change operation in a way that wasn't available to the Americans, say, in Libya or in Syria, or even, say, you know, certainly there was such a thing as the Iraqi National Congress and Ahmad Chalabi, if people remember those names from, you know, 22 years ago, that they thought was in place in Iraq. You know, the history that we're confronted with in terms of why this is going to be a catastrophe is certainly there. But I believe, like so many other administrations, so many other people in power, particularly megalomaniacs like we have in the White House, at the Pentagon with Hegseth, at State Department with Rubio, et cetera, that they feel that history doesn't apply to them. And that, yeah, I know we screwed up regime change operations here and there and over in this place and all throughout our history, but that was those people. And this is us. And that's why we'll be better at it. And this is the real danger of megalomaniacs in power like we have right now.
Yeah, and the proxies can get expensive. You know, ISIS-Daesh might have been cheaper in Syria, but certainly in Afghanistan, which you know so well, obviously the Mujahideen got very expensive when it led to 9/11. And let alone all the money spent on them and in American lives, which, of course, makes one think that if Netanyahu is stringing Trump along via these peace deals for an inevitable war on Iran, which is being presumably supported by the CIA and the State Department, how far do you think Trump? How far do you think Trump will go as he's pulled into it? He successfully somehow got himself out of his so-called 12-day war. Some people saying the war will start before the midterms in November.
You know, this is the dilemma we have with Donald Trump. We simply don't know what this man is thinking. And you know, not to be cute or light about it, we don't know if he knows what he's thinking. You know, in the sense that with previous presidents, you'd have an ability to see in their past decisions a way forward, right? So you can look at how they acted, and that would give you some gist, some understanding of how they may respond to something different, you know, as well as to just the legacies, the histories of their parties, and the fact that they're all so clearly imperialist presidents. Not saying Donald Trump isn't an imperialist president. He's just one who's cut from a different cloth. So, you know, with regards to Iran, certainly you can see his embrace of the Zionists, his warmth towards Benjamin Netanyahu, his relationship, say, with Miriam Adelson, the donor who has given $600 million to his political causes over the last decade. You know, you can see that relationship, and you can say, well, of course, you know, I could see him going forward with another war in Iran. But then there's the other side of it, too, where you say, you know what, all the reporting seems to suggest that his desire for a Nobel Peace Prize was legitimate. that this wasn't something bandied about like as some type of just story or rumor. He really, in his heart, wants that Nobel Peace Prize. So how is he going to get that if he launches another war, particularly such a ruinous one as would be with Iran? You know, how is he going to get that then? So, we're, you know, and then there are probably five or six other things we could introduce into the conversation to make it even harder to figure out or decipher or predict what Donald Trump might do. The problem is, let's get back to the beginning of our conversation, Afshin, the people around him, we know where they are in this. We know that they are either Zionists, that they are neoconservatives, that they have had a desire to see war in Iran for decades. Certainly, that is the leanings of those who are in the room with him when he's making these decisions. You know, whether or not the United States goes to war with Iran on behalf of Israel in the coming year, I think there's good money on it, just as well there is the ability to say, well, you know, that doesn't make sense politically or personally for Donald Trump, so it may not happen. But certainly, I think the prospects, you know, are nothing we can dismiss.
We're running out of time. Just finally, I mean, I wanted to ask you about whether you thought Ratcliffe was behind the Romania and Hungary energy facilities being blown up, whether the CIA is off on doing things like that behind Trump's back. But it would, do you think, be the end of Trump's presidency if he did launch into a war on, I mean, whether it would be Netanyahu who began it, into Iran? Would that be the end of Trump? We'd never see him again, presumably.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think that you know, his popularity among his base is still there, even though the idea of another Middle Eastern war, a war for Israel, et cetera, goes completely against the tenets of America First, which the MAGA movement supposedly is beholden to. I think the popularity among his base is such that it won't be shaken by something like that. The rest of the country already hates him. So I don't think a war in Iran would have that type of impact either way in terms of moving the base the base poll numbers, the base public opinion numbers on him. But the war like that would be catastrophic. It's a war that would devastate both Iran and Israel, as well as the larger region, the instability, the halting of commerce, et cetera. So the implications would be worldwide. And it also would expose the real American weakness that you know, Donald Trump famously a few weeks ago called Russia a paper tiger. Matthew, the Americans are a paper tiger.
Matthew, we're out of time, but Matthew, thanks so much.
Thank you, Afshin.
That's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those bereaved by the UK, US, EU armed genocide in Palestine. We'll be back on Saturday with a brand new episode. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country. And head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.